Faisal Khan, and this is North Fork Works.
Today, my guest is Al Krupski, who is Suffolk County legislator for the 1st District, and he's also my neighbour.
And we're sitting in his offices in Riverhead. Welcome, Al Krupski. I'm really looking forward to having this conversation with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
I'd like to start with going back in time a little bit. I don't know that people have a really good understanding of what it's like to be a politician from the inside. So I'm going to ask you to tell us a lot about yourself.
Sure.
But to start with, I know that you were born on the North Fork, mm-hmm. and that you are, therefore, a North Fork native, mm-hmm. and a fourth-generation farmer. Mm-hmm. I see, whenever I drive east, I see your sign, mm-hmm. this Krupski's Farm, mm-hmm. that sells pumpkins mm-hmm. and other things. But why don't you just talk
sure.
about that?
Okay. Well, I was born in Greenport Hospital, and I am a fourth-generation farmer in Peconic, and my great-grandfather farmed where Pindar Vineyard is in Peconic, and my grandfather farmed has his farm where Len's Vineyard is. And I grew up on the main road where our current farm stand is. And I raised my children. Mary and I live on Skunk Lane. Our farm is on Skunk Lane down there. And so we've been in that area for a long time.
Have you actually lived anywhere but the North Fork?
Except yeah. for college, no. And when I came back from college, I realized that I wanted to make the North Fork my home.
And where did you go to college? And
University of Delaware. I studied plant science. I have a degree in plant science, which has served me very well, not only as a farmer, but it served me because of the science background. It served me a lot in public life.
You were born on a farm. You were raised on a mm-hmm. farm. You worked mm-hmm. a farm. Mm-hmm. You are still a farmer? Mm-hmm. Do you still consider yourself a farmer?
Yes, absolutely. Because we still own the farmland. And it's not like another occupation where you can leave and go to something else. Because if you still have the land and you still practice it, it's really a lifestyle. So even though I can be in public service, I can do that at the same time. Because it's a family operation, so it's sort of a natural fit. I've been able to manage the time pretty well. The difference when I was with the town in various roles, it was easier because I didn't have to get dressed up to go to every single meeting. There were a lot of committee meetings and a lot of informal meetings. I could go in work clothes. With this job, I do have to get cleaned up a lot more. And the office is in Riverhead, so it's a lot more of a commitment to go to the office every day to go to work.
Has your farm itself changed?
Oh, yes. You mean over the years or just because of this office?
No, I meant more over the years.
Over the years, yes, it's changed a lot. When I grew up, in the 60s, everybody raised potatoes. It was almost a monoculture out here. We always had cucumbers because you needed a cash crop in the summer. Potatoes, you dig them in the fall, you sell them in the fall and in the winter. So in order to have income on the farm, especially in the summer where you're spending all the money, my father and grandfather raised cabbage and cauliflower, peppers and cucumbers, things like that. So they always had some row cropping besides potatoes. So we were exposed to that early on. There was a little bit of sweet corn. There were always some strawberries. There were always a few sweet potatoes. It wasn't dedicated acreage to those things, but it was always there. I can't eat cucumbers to this day because my sister and I pick so many of them. I just don't like the smell. We were certainly exposed to some things, but potatoes really ruled and dominated agriculture out here. So when I was in high school, we started raising pumpkins, and we kind of developed the farm away from wholesaling crops to retailing crops. So from the pumpkins, and they grew into all the other crops that we grow, tomatoes, sweet corn, melons, just for retail.
So does retail include picking your own?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we used to do peas, pick your own peas in the spring, and then, of course, pick your own pumpkins in the fall. We did for years, you know, kind of a U-cut cauliflower operation, but there just wasn't enough demand for that. The business, it's seasonal. And when you go from season to season, it's hard to evolve quickly, but you do evolve your operation over the course of time.
Talk a little bit about your political career. You started as a trustee.
Mm-hmm. When I graduated from college, I came back, and when I realized I wanted to live here and stay here, I was asked by my old chemistry teacher, Frank Kioski, who was a town trustee at the time in Southold, and Paul Stoutenberg, who was a town trustee, and then a town board member. And they said, do you want to run for town trustee? And I didn't know. I was a plant science major. I didn't know the first thing about politics. My family had never been involved politically. I didn't know the difference between a Republican and a Democrat or what a trustee did or anything.
You've learned, I suppose.
I've learned a few things since then. They asked me to run. I started going to the trustee meetings to find out what the role was. I ran in 1983. I didn't get elected. There was a special election in 1984. So they asked me to run for that seat, that open seat. I ran against a woman from Orient who was a conservative, and I ran as a Democrat. And the Board of Elections wouldn't resolve the election. So for a whole year, the seat was unfilled. And as a result of all the publicity we got for that year, we both got elected in 1985, the next year. And so I was a town trustee for 20 years, and then they changed the terms from 2 years to 4 years. So I served as a town trustee for 20 years. In that time, I worked with a tremendous variety of people, and I learned an awful lot about how government works from people, and also, you know, things about the environment. And then in the 80s, there was a huge push to develop the North Fork. The North Fork really was at a crossroads in the 80s because of all the development that was coming from the West. It was really the time when I think we got tested as far as what the North Fork was going to look like and what the culture was going to be on the North Fork. I mean, I really think we passed the test, and everyone decided that the North Fork should be preserved and as much of it as we could with our agricultural and aquacultural heritage. It was a long transition there, and there was a lot of big questions there back in the 80s because there was a lot of development pressure at the time.
What exactly do you mean by passing the test?
Well, you could have gone a different way. You could have gone for more downzoning, and you could have gone for higher density development, and you could have gone for the expressway coming all the way out to Matatuck or even further and bringing more people out and more commercial development, and you could have had big box stores, and you could have had fast food franchises and more traffic, and you could have had all that very easily.
And you were actually president of the trustees.
I was president for 14 years.
14 years. Mm-hmm. And then you went on to the
town board. 2005, I was elected to the town board. But it was the same sort of mentality the town board at the time had been working towards preserving Southold. They were focused in the right direction as far as land use and zoning. And the town boards that I served with, and those people were all added to that as far as land use and zoning. And it just kind of builds on itself at that point. Now, previous to me, of course, there was a fast food franchise that came into Matatuck. And that caused a lot of concern. The town board previous to me, they said, well, you can only have a fast food. You can't have standalone anymore. You can't have drive-thrus. You can only have fast food franchises in existing shopping centers or formula food. Again, that changes the look of the town completely. And when I got elected, there was a big drugstore chain that wanted to come into Southold. And we reacted quickly and we passed a big box store law that prevented big box stores from coming into town. I worked on the drainage code when I came to the town board because it had been so successful with the trustees. If you have a strong drainage code, that all your runoff goes into the aquifer, and you catch it while it's clean. So if you're taking your runoff from your property and discharging it right into the aquifer, it's clean water that helps the aquifer, but it also is less road runoff. So we passed a townwide drainage code, so every time someone comes in for a building permit, they have to comply with the drainage code. It's pretty simple, but it's effective because you get parcel by parcel, it all gets done.
You also were involved with developing a wind energy code and cellular tower laws.
Yeah, there's of course a lot of interest in renewable energy, but the problem there is you weigh property rights, as we did throughout all the years and all the things, with the benefit to the community and the effect on the community. So with the wind code says you have to be has to be associated with an agricultural operation on 7 acres or greater. When you start with something, you're not sure of the impacts. So we started very cautiously because some people wanted to put wind turbines up on smaller residential lots, and we didn't want to adversely affect the neighbors right off the bat. We kind of wanted to, it's almost like a learning curve. You want to put some up on some larger farms, and then you can kind of judge and gauge the impacts. It's not just the fall zone, it's also the possible noise, the noise impact. If it's going around and making noise all day, you know, that would be kind of unfair.
In your political life today, mm-hmm. let's just say before you became a legislator, mm-hmm. did you have some kind of vision or feeling or about what kind of place you wanted to live in? And related to that is, do you also have a particular view of what good government is? I just mm-hmm. wonder if the two questions are related.
You know, everyone has a different vision for their community. And I think the culture on the North Fork is that the community should stay the way it has and embrace its past. But as far as good government goes, I mean, I'm not sure good government really is people who work together despite either political differences or really any other differences. And you have to be able to to work on one issue and say, no, I disagree with you 100% on that, and I'm going to work hard to make sure what you proposed isn't going to work. And the next thing that comes up, to work 100% with them and support them completely, you have to take your ego out of it and take your personality out of it. I think that's the best way that government works. It goes back to your first question of working towards what your vision of what should be done, to the second question of how government should work, and so you work within those parameters. But working with people is really, and that's one thing I learned in all my years in town government, is you have to put aside any kind of differences if you're working towards the same goal.
Because when you were a trustee, there mm-hmm. were four other trustees besides mm-hmm. you.
Yes.
When you were in the town mm-hmm. board, there were five others. Mm-hmm. And now there's 17 others,
right.
17 other legislators.
Right.
Can you talk about that? I mean, how does that work in terms of, is that what you mean when you talk about working with other people?
Right, and within the town, you're all elected within the town. So you all pull together, whether it's Orient or Laurel or Fishers Island or Matatuck, it's still the town. With the county, it's different because it's divided up into 18 districts. So then it becomes a little more territorial over what happens in a specific district. So what might be the good for one district might not be good for the next district, and vice versa.
So let me just interrupt you and talk about what your district, what this the first legislative district is, so that people can get an understanding of what the variations in the county might
sure,
be.
Sure, sure. Oh, geographically, we go from Fishers Island. It's all of Southold. It's all of Riverhead and parts of Brookhaven. And it's part of Ridge, Manorville, all of Brookhaven Lab, part of Shirley, part of Seven Meridges, part of East Meridges. So unfortunately, the way it was redistricted, it cuts communities in half. And that's one thing that I really don't like about the gerrymandering, because I'd rather have all of Wading River, and I'd rather have all of Seven Meridges and all of East Meridges, because it's hard to represent a community there, because I meet with the community groups there. The fire departments are very important, the chambers, and you really want to represent the whole community instead of half. And they're literally cut street by street in half. So that's made it somewhat difficult to get a sense of what's important in those communities.
But this is the largest agricultural county. Suffolk
yes.
County is the largest agricultural county in New York. Mm-hmm. And the first district is the largest mm-hmm. of the districts in the county.
Yes.
And you are the first farmer to ever have the job.
Yes. And I keep reminding my colleagues from the built-out western districts that the seal of the legislature is a plow. So that's how important agriculture is. So I've been pushing that philosophy and saying that this is, if you look at the role Suffolk County plays, even in the state, it's such a big player agriculturally in it. And our strength in agriculture is the diversity of the operations, from really small backyard operations to, you know, some of the larger commercial nurseries or commercial greenhouses. That's what gives us our strength. And so I keep telling them, you know, that agriculture is so important to the county.
But yet, when you go further west, western Suffolk mm-hmm. and Nassau, I mean, those are very, very different places. How does that play out in real life? I mean, again, going back to the four, five, and now 17 other colleagues that you mm-hmm. have.
Well, it's just a matter of getting to have good relationships with them so that you have a level of trust. So when I say, you know, the season's a good season, growing season, they understand that, they believe me. You have to get a level of trust with your colleagues and a working relationship. The problem with 18, if I'm not on committees with some of the other legislators, then you don't develop, it's harder to develop a working relationship with people because you just never talk to them. There's 18 of them. So I'm chairman of the Public Works Committee, vice chairman of the Environment, Planning, and Agriculture Committee, and I'm on a member of the Seniors and Veterans Committee. So those legislators I work with, but the other ones, you know, you really don't have that much contact with. So you make an effort to reach out to them, but it's not as frequent.
You're listening to Al Krupski, Cutshog farmer and legislator in the 1st Legislative District of Suffolk County. He's talking about his life and work in local and county public service. This is North Fork Works on WPKN.
But which district is the closest? The South Fork must be.
Yes, we have an awful lot in common with District 2, which is the South Fork, which is Southampton and East Hampton, and a small part of Brookhaven. I asked, when I first got elected, why isn't it a four-year term? because it really is a steep learning curve. The county is so big, the county is so diverse. Coming from the North Fork and coming from South Old Town, where we really tried to go our own path, and then you go to look at the county, there's so many different issues that the county is faced with, and they're serious issues, and they all have to be dealt with. It's hard to learn all about those different issues in 2 years. It really should be a 4-year term. So you'd have, just to learn your district, just to meet with all your community groups and meet with all your chambers and all the people who take part in all the community activities and get to know what their concerns are. It takes time.
So when you were still at the town level, had you been thinking for some time you'd like to be at the county level?
No, this was more an opportunity that came up. And this is a more time-consuming job because of the travel, because Department of Public Works is in Yaphank, and because a lot of the business takes place in Hauppauge. It takes a long time to go from one end of the district to another. So before this, I really didn't have the time. The children were little. There was always a t-ball game. There was always a dance recital. There was always something going on with the children. Now that they're in college, it's kind of freed up a lot more time. So it's made this possible.
What were you thinking that being at the county level would give you that you didn't have at the town?
It's basically looking out, you know, for the East End, representing the East End and what that represents to the county and how important that is to the county.
So are you basically pleased with what's going on?
Yeah, I think we're making a difference. You know, if you look at county government as a whole, there have been some huge changes. The county's very heavily in debt. Since 2008, when the bubble burst, they relied on borrowing. There became a culture of borrowing for everything. There became a culture of not fixing and not maintaining what the county owned. Coming from Southall, which was very conservative in its borrowing, I've been trying to bring that sensibility to the county. So that kind of, I'm trying to change that culture at the county level, that we really need to pay for our services today and not burden the next generation. Let the next generation worry about what's important to them. We really need to take care of our own business today. And we're fortunate. There's a lot of good people, and I didn't know these people before, and I've gone around the past year meeting with the department heads, and you sit down with people and you say, okay, who are you? What do you do? Who are you? What do you do? Who are you? What do you do? The people, there's a lot of dedicated employees in the county. I was very impressed, and people who really care about serving the people. So that part's encouraging. The discouraging part is, you know, how do we pay for the services that the county provides? Because it's so complicated. You get into things. There's a controversy in Hauppauge over a big homeless shelter now. And how does the county deal with all these human problems? It's complicated and it's expensive.
But it's their job to do that, do you think?
It's our job, yeah.
Or should the county just not?
No, some things the county has taken on. You know, last year we voted to close a nursing home. You know, that was very traumatic. So there's things that the county got involved in they probably shouldn't have. But on the other hand, if you look at all these human service things, those are the problems that we have, and they have to be dealt with.
Do you think land use is the most important problem issue that you face?
Well, ultimately, land use and the environment are tied together. I've been working with the health department and planning on this. Of course, a big thing in the county now is the sewers and how to treat the wastewater from all these people. So we're looking at alternative septic systems for homeowners, for small developments, small commercial developments, and also looking at the big picture countywide and how wastewater is treated. So we really have to look closer at how we handle our wastewater treatment and how it affects us long term. So we are looking into that. There's a lot of different solutions. But the good part is there's a lot of good people in county government who are really willing to address this. From the county executive on down, this is not a lost cause.
What about the issue of food security? Mm-hmm. Is that something that you think about in terms of land use?
Yes, and that's what people get hung up on, I think, when it comes to land preservation, because I come from a culture where land preservation is extremely important. And then when you go further west, they don't really understand. They say, well, today, oh, well, they're growing grapes there, or they're growing sod, or they're growing nursery, a non-food crop. So why should we preserve that land? But if you look at food security, and if you look at, you know, millions of people on Long Island, whether you're counting Brooklyn and Queens or not as part of geographically Long Island, if you preserve that land, someday that land can be converted into food production. Today, it's in one crop. And I've seen the crops change in my lifetime. So agriculture has hundreds of years of change in its history, and it will continue to change. But if you preserve that land today, at least you have the opportunity to make those shifts into some other crop. because maybe someday you'll really need that food on Long Island.
It's developed. You can't roll it back.
Well, you're not going to plow up the strip mall. No.
So we've talked about a lot of people in the government. I'd like to find out what you think about the citizens or the stakeholders mm-hmm. or what, the people. People tend to always either blame government or mm-hmm. say government's too big. Mm-hmm. It's either too big or too small for a mm-hmm. lot of people.
Oh, of course. It's either too big. It's too big when they pay their taxes, but it's too small when they want different services.
Are you, though, mostly satisfied with your relationship with your citizens, your
I always encourage people to get involved more. And this district has a lot of concerned people. It has a lot of people who are active and are paying attention about local government, even trying to consider county as local government. And that's really important because you need their input. So I always encourage people in meeting with the different Chamber of Commerce's and the different community groups. And now, of course, I'm going further west, you know, meeting with the groups in Wading River or Calverton, and they have some very engaged groups there, people who are really concerned about land use and the environment. And that input's invaluable.
So you think that's more true of this district than say, further west?
All I know is that the people who live in my district really care about it, and they take the time to get involved, and their input is really, you know, and their interest is really important.
I was actually thinking also of this is, I think, objectively a very beautiful place that we live in, mm-hmm. the very east end of Long Island. I was wondering whether the people who come here already come with more engaged attitudes, or whether just being here and living here creates more engaged people.
No, I think it's both. I think the people who live here appreciate it for what it is, and I think the people who move here because of what it is. They all have a stake in keeping it for what it is.
So you mentioned the deer, but we really couldn't end this interview or go any further talking without talking about the deer, which today, a few days before this program goes on air, is still a very live issue.
Sure.
Could you talk about that and how you feel about it, both as a legislator and as a farmer?
Sure. Well, growing up, you know, I had access to a lot of different farm fields all over the North Fork, friends, relatives. And as kids, we were active, and we bike ride, and we walked all over the place, and you never saw a deer. And as kids going like to Orient State Park, you'd always think, oh man, it was exciting to imagine you saw a deer there. It was almost like kids playing cowboys and Indians or pirates or something, you know.
Seeing a unicorn.
It was exactly. Because there were no deer on the North Fork as a kid in the 60s and 70s. I remember once we saw a raccoon, and it was a big deal. There just weren't any.
What were there then instead?
Potato fields. Everything was potato fields. So you didn't have deer, you didn't have raccoons, you didn't have rats, you didn't see anything like that. So with less potatoes, you know, less of a monoculture and more fallow land, kind of overgrown land, there were always a deer population on Robbins Island. And once the deer started here, it was like, wow, that's really neat. I saw a deer today. And no one ever could have imagined that it could have grown into what it's become. As far as a farmer goes, in the beginning they said, okay. And Cornell Cooperative Extension was very helpful. They said, okay, they brought in biologists. And they said, well, if you put hair cuttings at the edge of the field, if you tie up soap on the hedgerows, you'll discourage the deer. And then we got electric cords from some of my neighbors, and we play radios at the edge of the field. It was always your station, don't worry. And
deer are very much a large part of our audience.
And so to try to keep the deer out of the fields at night, you know, we tried all different things, and that didn't work, of course, because no one knew that deer were that acclimated to people. Then we tried with the temporary electric fencing, and that had some success with a, you know, low-pressure deer situation. So then, okay, so it was a farmer's problem, and they're eating all your cabbage, and they're mowing down all your beans and strawberries, and that's one problem. That's one segment of the society that's affected by a growing deer population. And then people started to hit them on the roadways. That became really an epidemic of car crashes with deer. And now you're talking real public safety, because when the deer comes through your windshield, it's serious, and people have died, you know, in the North Fork, and of course elsewhere from deer collisions. And then, of course, the specter of Lyme disease and how the deer spread the ticks, because they're such big mammals, they can spread a lot of ticks very quickly. I've had Lyme disease twice. You know, there's very few people who haven't had someone in their family affected by the tick-borne illnesses. And that's something that no one ever foresaw. And then when Lewis Bacon bought Robbins Island, we went out there as trustees. And there wasn't a twig or a leaf in the whole understory, and you could see right through the island because the deer had devegetated everything.
How long ago was that?
I guess the 90s, sometime in the 90s. It was incredible to see. Wow, we were just amazed. He actually fenced in a small area to see how it would come back. And with no deer pressure, it does come back. But that's zero deer pressure because it's fenced in. So then to see that happen on the North Fork, to see that whole understory gone in so many places, and you lose your habitat for your ground nesting birds. You lose your replacement trees, which is really important when you have storms and everything blows over. Now you have invasives coming in to take their place. This is a serious environmental issue that's taken place. So you have so many different factors coming together. You know, it took the community a long time. It takes so many people to get involved that, oh, this is affecting this, this is affecting that. We should really do something. The current hunting law, and I'm not really a hunter. Growing up, we never had a gun, and my grandfather and my grandfathers, they never hunted because there was really nothing to hunt.
Your son's a hunter.
My son is a hunter. We don't know where he got it from. He must be a throwback to some previous generation, because he is, and he's a real hunter. He really understands it, and he really enjoys it. But in his lifetime, of course, there were things to hunt. And the Canadian geese. As a kid, the big flocks of Canadian geese would fly over in the fall, and they were beautiful. And then there were a lot more open acreage for the geese to land in, and they never really landed on the North Fork. The people who hunted used to go to Delaware, Eastern Shore, Maryland, to hunt. And there was really no goose hunting. There was duck hunting, because you had the duck population out here, especially on the creeks and on the bay. But there was really no goose hunting. And now you've got this resident goose population. And then if you look at how it affects quality of life, you look at how many thousand geese are on different bodies of surface water every day, loading nitrogen and loading bacteria into the groundwater. Now, some of our creeks are closed because of bacteria that the state is supposed to test for bacteria loading. A lot of the contribution is from geese. So now you can't shellfish because of the geese. And so you look at things that have changed just in my lifetime, and the management strategies for these animals have to change with them. It becomes public safety, and it becomes quality of life, and really you need to do something to control these populations.
Do you have reservations about what is entailed?
Most people eat meat, and most people enjoy eating meat. So that's how you eat meat. You have to kill the animal to eat the meat.
The deer and the geese.
Right. If the hunting seasons were changed, a lot of these problems would solve themselves. People could eat the meat and limit the populations. We need to be the manager again and then manage that population down. You know, you have to just take it as a change the culture to say this is normal. You're going to eat venison. We raised our children on venison. And, you know, you're going to eat the geese because it's a good source of protein and you should be feeding people.
And so are you comfortable that this will be resolved or this will be managed, the management will take effect, say, by the end of the year?
Oh, no, not by the end of the year. This is more long term. I'm comfortable that enough people are involved at the state level where they make the laws to change it, you know, to allow the population to be brought under control. I can see that at the state level, working with Peter Scully from the DEC, from Region 1, hopefully up to the governor's office, that he would, in fact, see that we need to do something to help Long Island.
So thank you very much, Al. This was really, really interesting. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Hazel. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Al Krupski, Cutchock farmer and Suffolk County legislator, talking about his life and work in local and county public service. North Fork Works is heard on the first Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport, serving the communities of Suffolk, Fairfield, New Haven, and Litchfield counties, and streaming on wpkn.org. North Fork Works is produced by Tony Ernst and archived at hazelkahn.org.